When a young person is injured or loses his or her life to gang violence or an officer-involved encounter, how are other young people affected? And what is the city of Sacramento doing about that? On Insight, some answers to those questions from CAP Radio reporter Sammy Kayola. She's been exploring the impact of the Stephon Clark shooting and tracking new efforts to reach out to some of Sacramento's young people. Then we will hear about the debut record by the brother-sister duo Me and You. It's out today. You'll hear my conversation with the musicians Connor and Carly Hormel. And if you appreciate baseball and baseball history, do stay for the end of the hour. We're going to preview a new exhibit opening this weekend at the California Museum. It includes treasures from some of the greatest names in baseball's history. I'll talk with historians Alan O'Connor and Stephen Wong. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Sunday night, a 16-year-old on a bike near Rio Linda Boulevard was stopped by police for code violations. Then he took off on foot. Then there was a chase. And during the chase, the teenager was hit by a Sacramento police car. So he was taken to the hospital. He's okay, but the situation drew quite a crowd in North Sacramento, and there's continuing conversation about the circumstances. What is the impact on young people when an incident like that or something more intense, say gang violence or an officer-involved shooting, happens in the neighborhood and then becomes high profile? CAP Radio reporter Sammy Kayola has been focused on this question this summer. She's here to talk about the series that she produced and the body of work surrounding it. Hi, Sammy.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me.
I think this came out of the Stephon Clark shooting, which is worlds away from the incident that I just described on Sunday night. However, there is a common denominator.
Yeah, so we're really looking at neighborhoods where there's a lot of violence, you know, whether it's police or it's gang violence, their youth that live there, and they're seeing people around them get arrested, people around them get killed, and they're stressed. They're really on edge, and they're trying to figure out, well, what does this mean for me? I live here. What do I do? What is my future like? And what we're seeing is a lot of community groups coming together to try to, you know, sort of reshape the way that youth, especially youth of color, see themselves and see what they can do in the world.
It's difficult to gauge, I think, and gather data on the impact as we're describing it. But you have been tracking some of the changes, particularly in the African-American neighborhoods, since Stephon Clark's death in March. What are you learning? What's going on?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Right after Stephon Clark died, you saw a lot of calls for police accountability, but you also saw this sort of parallel demand for more resources in these neighborhoods, for economic equity, for better opportunities, mostly for kids. You know, they really want to build safer, more optimistic places for children to grow up. And so I really wanted to see, well, what are they doing and how do they even do that? And so one of the first places that I went was at El Paso Heights Community Center, and I found some teens there who were working. They had just been placed in jobs. One of them, his name is LeJames Riggins. It's a little windy, but I asked him, what do you want to do? And he said he really wanted to be an engineer or a botanist. And I said, what would get in your way of that?
Getting shot. Just in my own neighborhood, that's pretty much it. I thought Oakland was worse than Sac. Now it's starting to feel like Sac is just a little bit, it's getting there on the worry list.
So he's saying he has plans for college, but he's also very aware that he might be one of the kids that's shot in the neighborhood. That's a very real fear for him.
Yeah, for a lot of them, it's, could I be next? Right? What if I get wrapped up with the wrong people? Or what if I don't and I'm just stopped on the street? And what if I do the wrong thing when the police officer talks to me?
So right? That's motivating him to want to stay out of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's in a job this summer and he feels like if I can just stay on track, that'll be okay. And so he's one of about 500 kids that are part of this 1,000 Strong program. It's something
the mayor's program.
The mayor put into place. And, you know, they're growing the program and they're trying to get city departments and restaurants and tech companies to really sign on to take in youth from these neighborhoods and to give them a chance.
In your reporting, you do make the connection, and would you explain it here, between a job opportunity and combating violence?
Right. You wouldn't necessarily think, oh, yeah, we're going to stop gang violence with a job.
Or that maybe it's a possibility, but is there a more direct correlation?
Yeah, I think it's really that, you know, youth need to feel like they have a purpose, right? They have a mission. They need to feel confident and that they're going somewhere, that they can do what they want to do beyond their streets, beyond their neighborhood. And I think youth can start to feel a little bit trapped. I heard a lot of kids express they just felt like they either were going to die or they were going to be in trouble or there wasn't anything for them to do. So they were just going to stay there and just hang out at night. And so I think this idea of getting them into employment, it just exposes them to an idea. Like I talked to a kid who is working for the city this summer and he's doing maintenance facility. He's fixing things in city buildings. He's doing, you know, technical work. And he never had been exposed to that before. He didn't know anybody who did that, but he's good at it. Right. And now he's saying that's what he wants to do. So, yeah, I think the thought is that you just keep kids on a track toward college or toward a career, that it'll keep them safer somehow.
And changing the possibilities that they can conceive of or step into is an avenue to really change things. I know that's a variation of what we hear Mayor Steinberg talking about.
Yeah. So Mayor Steinberg has been really big on this. He's been working with Build Black, which is that group we saw come out of Stephon Clark, and also with the Black Child Legacy Campaign. That's sort of a neighborhood coalition working with the Sierra Health Foundation. And even the Sacramento Kings have gotten involved here. So here is what Mayor Steinberg wants to see sort of in the long term.
A large part of the employment sector, no doubt, is going to be downtown. But we actually want to build employment bases in these neighborhoods. In other words, it shouldn't just be about transporting kids out of their neighborhoods for good experiences and then bring them back to their neighborhoods that remain the way they are. It's actually about improving the neighborhoods as well.
That's an interesting description because I know field trips out of the neighborhood to different places were quite common decades ago, and that was exposure to different possibilities. But I see how making that lifestyle homegrown as an opportunity can really make a change. So take me to parents and mentors in the community and their involvement. Do they think this is going to work?
Yeah, they're hoping so. I mean, there's a lot of excitement around this. There's a lot of positivity. They're trying to really raise these kids, to feel okay about this, to not always be thinking, oh my God, there's going to be another thing that's happening. What am I going to do? So, you know, they're happy to have the support of the city and the county and the Kings and to have real motion going on, again, so that these kids don't feel so trapped. And it's not just teenagers. You know, a lot of children, you would be surprised, they understand what happened to Stephon Clark. They watch the news. They've seen videos. And not just Stephon Clark, but police shootings in other states all over America, you know, and they see that and it affects them and it's its own kind of trauma. I actually went to an elementary school in Meadowview where they were reading a children's book about police shooting an unarmed Black man, an illustrated children's book called Something Happened in Our Town. And it was all in, you know, child-friendly language, but it talked about race. It talked about police injustice. It went all the way back to slavery, you know. So, and these kids were 7, 8, 9 years old. So, yeah, that was, you know, really eye-opening that, you know, children are aware of this and it affects the way that they grow up. So I talked to a dad. His name is Latrell Led, and he has a 9-year-old. And he's really excited to be a dad. But, you know, he has to talk to his son about this kind of thing. And he's really transparent about it. And I said, you know, how do you counter all of that stress, all of what's going on around you? And he says, I just try to keep Latrell Jr., you know, I just try to keep him confident and motivated. And I want him to see other people thriving around him. And here's how he talks about it.
Everything is not geared toward the negative. You know, there's something out there that can bring out the positive. And we have to love our brown babies. We have to love African-American children. And, you know, especially those kids that don't have nothing, you know, that the parents are just kind of like they're on the back burner all the time.
You're listening to Cap Radio reporter Sammy Caola. We are talking about the issues in her three-part series, which has been airing this summer. You can find all of the reports at capradio.org. The investigation into the Stephon Clark shooting at both the local and state levels is ongoing. The case has not yet been handed to the DA's office. So what comes next in this arena that you've been focused on?
Yeah. So, you know, Black Lives Matter Sacramento is still protesting. You know, you're going to see a lot of discussion around the Stephon Clark case on sort of the law enforcement level. And at the same time, I think we are going to keep seeing these events around boosting up Black youth. You know, they're sort of trying to build some safe spaces, some, you know, not distractions, but some sort of counter, you know, to say, look, you're going to be seeing protests on the street. There's going to be a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. But let's also talk about you and your goals and what we can do. And so, you know, I went to an event with the Sacramento Kings a few weeks ago where they sort of had this forum with youth about what they want to do with their lives. They started a Kings and Queens basketball league. And, you know, the city is also doing these grants. It's about $900,000 in funding. And they've picked 14 groups that are entrepreneurial in nature, you know, that are, some of them are maker spaces and some of them are arts organizations that are going to be in these neighborhoods, and they're going to be
all involving kids.
Yeah.
And youth activities.
Right. So these groups that are getting the grants, they basically vowed to be inclusive with their employment. So that's going to be interesting, you know, to have these little incubators in these neighborhoods. And I mean, that's really a concrete way to expose teens to what they can do.
And the mayor's program, as you said, is titled 1,000 Strong. They're at 500. So there's capacity there for the program to double in size.
Yeah, that's the goal. That's the goal. And, you know, a lot of that might depend on Measure U, which is coming up. I know Mayor Steinberg has a lot of big goals, not just for teens, but as I said, for children, you know, for improving schools, for just improving these neighborhoods that have for a long time felt neglected.
So can I wrap this up by asking you what was eye-opening to you? You went in with a question. You talked to a lot of people, talked to a lot of kids, and observed what's been happening. Were there surprises for you?
I think I really was surprised by how deeply this affects children and teens. You know, I knew that it was happening in their world. I thought it was sort of over their head somewhere, something their parents were dealing with. But it's really them. You know, some of their friends are getting shot. Some of their friends are going to jail. And it really, you know, it can make them feel stifled and can make them feel like no one cares about me. And you know, it's sort of heartbreaking to talk to kids who are 15, 16, 17 who feel that way and who just haven't been given the opportunities that they need to thrive. And so, you know, you'll see if you go on capradio.org, you'll find my piece. And we have this poem. It's called A Poetic Service Announcement. And that's from the Black Child Legacy Campaign. They basically asked teens to talk. And they filmed them. And it's really awakening.
There's one by Simone Hall, and I wrote down some of her language. She says, "There is no therapy for this hood. This is the war that America refuses to acknowledge." And it's worth watching these PSAs, but it's also worth understanding how eloquent and wise these very young people are about what's happening around them. They have a language for it. They have an explanation for it. And in every one of the messages, they are asking for attention and for help.
Yeah, they are. So, you know, I know there's a lot of work on the ground to give it to them, and I'm excited to see where that goes.
Sammy, thank you so much. I think it's been a terrific series, and I'm really glad that you took time to share it with us on Insight.
Thanks for having me, Beth.
That is Cap Radio reporter Sammy Caola. You can find links to her series of reports at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. We're going to check in with Steve Milne in the newsroom for more news headlines. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Beth. California's power grid operators are calling for voluntary electricity conservation today and tomorrow as the western U.S. braces for another day of scorching heat. Temperatures are expected to top 100 degrees today throughout the region. Today in Sacramento is expected to be 101. The California Independent System Operator, or CAISO, is asking for people to ease off blasting the air conditioning or using the washer or other appliances between 5 and 9 p.m. when power usage peaks. CAISO says that reduces the risk of rotating power outages. The agency says it doesn't anticipate any rolling blackouts unless there's an unforeseen problem, like a wildfire takes out a line or a large power generator goes out of service. Los Angeles police now say a Trader Joe's employee killed during a shootout between police and a suspect was hit by an officer's bullet. LA's police chief told reporters this morning the suspect fired at officers Saturday after crashing a car outside the market and the officers returned fire. The chief says 27-year-old store employee Melida Corrado had run to the front of the store with others at the time of the crash and was near the suspect, 28-year-old Jean Evan Atkins. Atkins earlier shot and wounded his 76-year-old grandmother at their South Los Angeles home and fled in a car, taking with him a teenage girl who was grazed by a bullet. Police have filed numerous charges against Atkins. Nevada voters could soon make history by electing the country's first female-majority state legislature. After winning a record number of primary contests last month, women could make up nearly two-thirds of the state house, depending on the outcomes of this November's vote. Women are favored to control 27 seats heading into the 2019 Nevada legislature. 19 of those are in the Assembly and 8 in the Senate. Follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A debut record by the brother-sister duo Me and You is being released today. The musicians are Connor and Carly Hormel from Carmichael, California. They were with us late last year when they were finishing the album, which is called Chasing Trails EP. So let's listen to the conversation. Here are Connor and Carly talking about how the project came together.
We spent the whole summer in the mountains kind of working on a lot of demos and stuff from what we had written in New Zealand. And we came back this fall semester. I'm down at school in LA and started kind of sharing our demos with some people. And luckily, this producer heard it and we, for some odd reason, liked it. And, you know,
we still can't figure out why.
It's like a dream come true to us. And so we've been working with him through the semester.
His name's Ben Tolliday.
Yeah. And he works with our favorite folk band, Lord Huron. So we were in their studio just last week working on some demos for the record.
So, Connor, you're still here.
Yeah.
And you're spending time in the home studio that your parents built in Carmichael.
Yeah. We kind of have a pool house in our backyard that's detached from the house. So I've slowly just started moving my parents' stuff out of there and moving my stuff in, just seeing how slow I can do it so they won't notice over the years.
When did music start for the two of you?
We grew up with a drum set, a big piano, and guitar in our household. And so our dad was a musician.
He kind of bought it before we were born.
Yeah, so we were sitting on their laps, you know, pretending to play as kids and then coming together to play. And played through middle school. He was in a boy band. I did a solo thing. And that was a weird...
the Jonas Brothers phase.
Yeah,
what was your boy band called?
Oh, man. We had a bunch of different names. What was our name?
I think it was like your initials.
I don't even remember. I think it was like a really stupid, clever initial thing.
At one point in the pool house, we had, do you remember our first band name?
Rock on Fire.
Yeah,
we rocked.
So you said you spent a lot of time in the mountains, meaning the Sierra.
Yeah.
And then you said New Zealand. And so that was a very big trip.
Yeah. It was huge, and sort of meant to be in a sense. I had the opportunity to study abroad in New Zealand. So I was there for like about 5-6 months. And then Connor was fortunate enough to come over and we lived in a camper van together. And
For a month with your sister.
And, you know, here we are. Yeah. We made it. Yeah, so that's where we wrote this whole new EP. It's going to be called Chasing Trails. And it was the inspiration for this record, the inspiration for me and you, kind of a change in our music, in our career.
A lot of self-discovery, that trip, and kind of figuring out what we want to be all about and what we can do good and put forth good things with our music and love and
all let's
that.
Introduce everybody to your indie folk sound. You're actually going to perform Chasing Trails for us in the studio.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Carly and Connor Hormel. Here they are, Me and You.
There is life beyond the pines, through the trees, it's calling out my name. And I'm wondering, there's a path through it. Fallen dirt and dust will cover up my face, and I will be okay. Out in the valley, over the rocks and the clay, I'll be chasing trails until I find my way.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Connor and Carly Hormel. They are the sister-brother duo, Me and You. When it's sister and brother, there's a similarity, a sameness to the voices that's so fun to listen to.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And because you're so close in age, if you told me you were fraternal twins...
We get that a lot.
Do you? I would believe it.
It's funny. When people see us play, they either ask if we're twins or we're dating. And we're neither.
Definitely not twins. Definitely not dating.
Yeah.
What's the meaning of Me and You? How did that duo name happen?
You know,
We used to be called Connor and Carly, which was crazy creative, clearly.
Kind of in New Zealand, we just started really thinking about our lives as musicians and what we want to do with our music. And we are really all about togetherness and being together in music. And so for us, Me and You not only means Connor and I, but it's me, us, and you, the audience. And so for us, it's at our shows, we want to bring people together through music. We believe that, you know, if anything's going to change in the world, it's going to be me and you that have to do it together.
Restless night in the city street. Hopped on a train down to New Orleans, she's wasted. Brand new night in same old sheets. Knows how to fake the love, but she can't taste it. She won't make it. Georgia, the thought that I told you. Tipping back the bottle, handing out your love for free. Little Senora, California. You can't find yourself a honey, make a little memory. You can learn a little something, cause love is really what you need. Out the door, took all the things he said, left you naked. Packed up your jeans from your dresser drawer. No more making love without a conversation. Oh, she can't take it, Georgia. You need.
That was Me and You, Connor and Carly Hormel. They are playing at Ace of Spades this Saturday at noon. It's part of a benefit for Girls Rock Sacramento. And their Chasing Trails EP is available on all the streaming platforms, also on our website. And we have a video of them performing the title track live in the Insight studio. You can find it at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Oh, you're in the spirit now, aren't you? You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak, but let's change those words from take me out to the ball game to take me out to the museum. Because opening this weekend, a brand new exhibit at the California Museum in Sacramento titled California at Bat, America's Pastime in the Golden State. And there's a lot of treasure in the exhibit to talk about. So joining me in the studio is Sacramento baseball historian Alan O'Connor. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Beth. Good to be here.
Glad to have you here on Insight. And joining us by phone is, I'm going to say, the world-famous baseball historian and collector, Stephen Wong. He's actually living and working in Hong Kong, and he's on the phone now. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Beth. How are you?
Glad to have you here. So, Stephen, I understand that a number of your items were loaned to the California Museum for this exhibit. So can you tell me a bit of the storyline of your contribution?
Well, I had done a number of exhibitions in the past, and I was serendipitously contacted by the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia, which I did a 3-year exhibition with them in from 2014 to 2017. And they were kind enough to put me in touch with Amanda Meeker and Brenna Hamilton of the California Museum. And me being a native of California, I grew up in Los Altos Hills, which is, just called 40 minutes south of San Francisco. And having basically spent my life until a teenager before my parents moved back to Hong Kong, I felt it was an incredible project to be a part of. And so I have a large collection that's really dedicated to the game-worn uniforms, game-used bats, and all sorts of memorabilia that complement the players that I collect in my collection. And a lot of those happen to have a heritage within California, such as, Ted Williams being born and raised in San Diego, Joe DiMaggio and his two brothers, Vince and Dom, from obviously the Bay Area, Harry Hooper, graduate of St. Mary's College and growing up, born and raised in the Silicon Valley. So I thought this was just the perfect fit, and I felt it would be a great honor to share the collection with members of the public. And obviously in a state that is very dear to me, from the childhood beginning.
You've written 3 Smithsonian books on baseball and have had a lot of attention on these items. For you, and based on the public reaction, which of the treasures in the California Museum exhibit is most exciting, draws the most kind of gasps or oohs and ahs?
Well, sure. I mean, I think it'll be obviously, the big names. They have Joe DiMaggio's New York Yankees home rookie uniform. The uniform that Joe DiMaggio wore in his rookie year in 1936. It was the only year he wore number 9, starting in 37 until the end of his career. After the 51 season, he wore number 5. So obviously that's kind of one of the highlights. We have Ted Williams' uniform he wore in the 1950 season, his home uniform. So all the games that were played at Fenway Park, and his cap as well as his glove from the mid-50s, and his bat he also used in the 1950 season. We'll have obviously Willie Mays' San Francisco Giants home jersey he wore in the 1965 season, which is the year that he hit 52 home runs, leading the National League and winning his second National League MVP award. And, of course, there's always Sandy Koufax draws a lot of awes. We have his game-worn Los Angeles Dodgers road jersey he wore in 1966, which, of course, was his last season in the majors in the year in which he won his third and final Cy Young Award. So there's just a lot of, historically significant items, not to mention the other items that, the museum was able to source. But I think in aggregate, this would be a very, very exciting exhibition, given the breadth and the, the magnitude of material that this exhibition has. And it's a real, real tribute, obviously, to California's long heritage and history within Major League Baseball.
That's Stephen Wong. He is the current chairman of investment banking for Hong Kong at Goldman Sachs. He's on the phone with us from Hong Kong. We're talking about the new baseball exhibit that opens this Sunday at the California Museum in Sacramento. In the studio with me is Alan O'Connor, who is a Sacramento baseball-focused historian. And Alan, Major League Baseball came to California in 1958, but the history of the sport in the state can be traced far back in time from then.
Yes, baseball actually came to California with the gold rush. When people came out in the wagon trains and however they got here on ships and whatnot, they brought their bats and balls with them. The game continued to be played here in California. The first reference to baseball in Sacramento, at least documentation, we know it was going on before then, is in 1859 mm-hmm. when one team posted an invitation to come play them. That's how it was done in those days. They'd get a group of folks together, and they'd put an ad in the paper and say, we've got a team. We'll meet you at 14th, the ballpark at 14th and R, and we'll play a game. And they would do that, and the game would be over, and then they'd celebrate. So it was a big deal. There'd be one game on a Sunday, and it was a different kind of an era. But as things grew, they had more games, more teams. Leagues started forming. It started as a gentleman's game, but by the 1860s, it was the best athletes, basically, and some money started getting into it. There was some gate splitting. There were a little gambling on the side, that kind of thing. And before you know it, we had professional baseball. National League started in 1876. In California, people are probably surprised to know that we had true professional baseball in the 1880s. The California League started in 1883. Sacramento had an entry in it in 1886. At that time, Los Angeles was still too far away, too small, not enough water, not enough transportation. But we had professional baseball in the 1880s here. And that continued intermittently. Economic times took us away from baseball because of different depressions and whatnot. But we've had professional baseball in Sacramento from 1883 at a high level up till 1957. And the OPCL was higher than the current AAA Rivercats.
In fact, I think from your collection, there are medals, baseball medals, that go back to
yes.
the 1880s.
It was such a big deal that when they had these games on a Sunday, you'd have Grass Valley playing other towns up in the foothills. And there were medals for great play during those games. And on exhibit, I have from 1880s a home run medal. A home run was a big deal in those days. So one of the players hit a home run and they gave him a medal because it was kind of an unheard of event in those days. The
wow.
rules of baseball were a lot different then. Yeah.
So, Stephen, was California, by your measure, considered a part of baseball history even before Major League Baseball came to the state, because California was the home for some of the great players and there was some of this history that Alan's talking about?
Yeah, very much. I think Alan hit the nail on the head that, a lot of people don't really associate California with a long history or heritage in baseball history. And that's what one of the main reasons that I got very excited about this particular exhibition. It's not only really to showcase a lot of the, richly historical artifacts that the exhibition is going to have, but it also was a great way to actually educate people and share the heritage and the history that California, as well as Sacramento in of itself, has with, within baseball history. A lot of people associate east of the Mississippi River as sort of the you know, the reservoir of baseball history, but that's not actually the case, as Alan so articulately, you know, just went through. And so, you know, beyond that, I think a lot of people would be very surprised, too, about the breadth of actual superstars, let alone players that resonate, you know, in terms of name, you know, today, just as the time when they played, be it Orlando Cepeda, Raleigh Fingers, Fernando Valenzuela. You know, we have his Los Angeles Dodgers home jersey that he wore in 1981. We all can vividly recall the cover of Sports Illustrated, you know, back in 1981, where it was, you know, Fernando Mania, and basically that whole year he took baseball by storm. You know, guys like Ricky Henderson, you know, Bill Pierce, Duke Schneider, Nolan Ryan, Gaylord Perry. These are all, you know, players that many of them are in the Hall of Fame. Many of them have played for California teams. And those that haven't, such as Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio, Vince DiMaggio, and Dom DiMaggio, many of those players are very, very famous, but not a lot of people know that they actually, you know, were born, raised, or had a significant part of their life based in California, you know, before they went to the major league. So I think that this is going to be very, very exciting, a story to tell, you know, museum visitors.
That's Stephen Wong. I'm also talking with Alan O'Connor. The exhibit, California at Bat, America's Pastime in the Golden State, opens this Sunday. There's a big public event from noon to four. There will be food trucks. If you have some memorabilia, you can bring it. Collectors will assess it. And I think because people know a lot of the area teams, Alan, it will be fun to see uniforms from, you have in your collection, quite a variety of teams, not just the Sacramento Solons and the Senators.
Right. We, on exhibit, we have other Pacific Coast League historical folks that are going to put on display old San Diego Padres uniforms, the old San Francisco Seals uniforms. I have Sacramento Senators uniforms and Solons uniforms. But one quick point I'll make, Beth, is from 1903 to 1957, the old Pacific Coast League was considered by many to be the third major league. You know, a vote was taken. Do we bring the teams out from the East or do we make it the third major league? And New York had a little bit more money than some of the California folks did, and it went a different direction than it could have.
Stephen, this exhibit also focuses on some of the changes and the Jackie Robinson era, the openness that baseball grew through and had. And I think that's an important history line that people should know about what's on display.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jackie Robinson, we saved the best for last, of course, him, you know, arguably being one of the most important figures in American history, let alone baseball history, you know, was raised in California. You know, he was born in Georgia, but the family moved to Southern California, went to UCLA, had a prominent athletic career at UCLA, and obviously, you know, the man who broke the color barrier in 1947 with Branch Rickey and the Brooklyn Dodgers. We have a lot of artifacts associated with Robinson, from, you know, the actual ticket to the game on April 15th, 1947 at Ebbets Field.
Wow.
Which was the first day in which an African-American ball player stepped foot in a Major League baseball stadium and played baseball in the major leagues. We have the program that was also at that game, pin back buttons and all sorts of memorabilia of diverse variety that commemorate the Brooklyn Dodgers and Jackie Robinson. And, you know, I think it just so happens that, again, I talked about Williams and Koufax and Mays and all these greats, but, you know, to also have Jackie Robinson be a pivotal part of California history and his input in the major leagues, it just makes this exhibition even that much more special.
Alan, let's also acknowledge the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. And then on top of that, we had the Japanese American and Mexican American leagues. So baseball in the state really fanned out everywhere. It seems that there were no limits on who was exploring the sport.
Yeah, that's correct. I grew up in Sacramento, and when I was a kid, there was always baseball being played. There were, you'd see thousands of people at the local parks, Land Park, McKinley Park, watching baseball on the weekends. It was a different world, and certainly there were a lot of teams that a lot of Mexican-American teams played, Japanese-American teams played. There was a lot of diversity in baseball back in the 1940s and 50s in state of California.
Have the two of you met yet, ever?
No, we haven't. We'll probably meet Friday night.
Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Yeah. We share similar passions in that we both love the game-used products or the game-used artifacts of our heroes. Yeah. And my heroes are local guys from Sacramento, and Stevens are major league guys. So we're different ends of the spectrum. Yeah. Although we cross over quite a bit.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very exciting, Beth. I really, I've done a lot of exhibitions, over the past sort of 10 to 15 years. This one really excites me. A lot of it is because I think this is an exhibition whereby a lot of people will learn a lot of new things. I've learned stuff, to be very honest, just kind of doing my own research ahead of being a part of this project. A lot of things that Alan will have already known, but, I'm not sort of an expert in the history of baseball within California, let alone Sacramento. But learning about that and being a part of this exhibition that really commemorates a very important state within America and its input, that is west of the Mississippi, I think is really exciting.
So I'm going to put in a plug for Alan's book. It came out more than 10 years ago, but it is titled Gold on the Diamond, Sacramento's Great Baseball Players, 1886 to 1976. It has a lot of great history in it. And I know that you continue to meet and speak with groups. So if anybody's interested in that, you're available, aren't you?
Right. And the book will be available at the museum.
Okay. And Stephen, you're working on a new exhibit for the Smithsonian. What's the timetable on that one?
Yeah, so that's going to open in June of next year, June 2019. The title of the exhibition is Baseball, America's Home Run, and it's going to be at the Smithsonian National Postal Museum, which was basically founded, the building that it's in, which is right across from the Union train station, was built in 1914, and it was actually built on a place that was known as Swampoodle Grounds, which was actually the home of Washington, D.C.'s very first baseball field. So, over the course of the 20th century, the Postal Museum has commemorated baseball history through original art and that was turned into stamps that commemorated a lot of the great players of the 20th century, be it Jackie Robinson, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams, and Willie Mays, on and on and on. And it also commemorated several, important events in baseball history, be it particular World Series like Mazeroski's home run, Bobby Thompson's shot heard around the world in the 1951 playoffs. And it has a rich heritage in baseball. And I told the Smithsonian, you go to the Smithsonian museums and you see incredible collections of Civil War and all sorts of Americana. But when it comes to baseball, it's always been relatively weak. And so hopefully this will change that.
Well,
but it does open in June of 2019, and it's very exciting.
Stephen, thank you so much for your time. And I'll again say that there are more than 80 artifacts on loan from your collection. People can look forward to seeing you this weekend. Thanks for your time and your contribution.
Thank you for having me on here. I look forward to see you and Alan on Friday and Sunday.
And Alan O'Connor, it's a pleasure. You can come talk baseball with me anytime, okay?
Thank you.
And there are more than 60 items from your collection, so I know you'll be out there greeting people as well. Thanks for joining us today on Insight.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. Another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.